like to welcome you to our scheduled District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy meeting. Today is February the 7th, 2019, and the time is 9:38. We will begin by having introductions from Board of Pharmacy members and staff, and then we will ask if you will be so kind as to introduce yourselves and make sure you sign the attendance list. And during your introduction, if you are affiliated with any entity, please state that as well. So, again, welcome. I will begin. I'm Daphne Bernard, board member.
Good morning, James Appleby, board member.
Tamara McCants, board member.
Good morning, Alan Friedman, board member.
Benjamin Miles, board member.
Thank you. And so our staff present.
Good morning. My name is Justin Ortiz. I'm in place for Dr. Sean White.
Corinne Barron, health licensing specialist for the D.C. Board of Pharmacy.
Luann Greenaway, health licensing specialist.
Good morning, Carla Wood, assistant general counsel.
Thank you. And so now we'll begin to my left by again having you please give your name and any entity that you're affiliated with.
Hi, Jennifer Thomas, the Center of the Public Prison Organization.
John Zawada, D.C. Public.
Good morning, Summer Muckel. I'm a fourth year pharmacy student at Howard University College of Pharmacy.
Josh Bailey, the community Walgreens specialty and Washington D.C. Department of Education President.
Denise Coluto, Walgreens.
Morning, I'm Jay Phillips with Walgreens.
Federica Falls, student.
Good morning, Deidre Payne, Walmart.
Thank you. And so, just as a reminder, please sign the attendance list before you leave. And so, we have a pretty full agenda today. We're going to get started with the first item that's on our agenda, and that is approval of our open session meeting minutes from December the 6th, 2018, as well as January the 3rd, 2019. It is my recommendation we may want to entertain two separate motions for these because I'm not sure who might have been present or not. So if you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, we will gladly entertain a motion.
I'll move for approval of the December 2018 open session minutes.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Is there a general consensus in favor of the motion? Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Wait, December?
December 6th.
I'll abstain, sorry.
Okay.
I have to abstain also.
Okay, so let's do a roll call if that's better. So we'll start with you then.
I'm in. Benjamin Miles in favor of the motion.
Okay.
Alan Friedman abstain.
Tamara McCants abstain.
James Appleby in favor of the motion.
Daphne Bernard in favor of the motion. The motion carries. Okay, so the next set of minutes are from January the 3rd, 2019. And just for the sake of it, we'll do a roll call vote on those as well. So we'll begin with Dr. Bernard. Is there a motion?
I'll move that we approve the January 3rd open session minutes.
Okay, second.
Second.
Is there general consensus in favor of the motion? Okay. All right, so roll call vote. We'll start with Dr. Miles.
Benjamin Miles, in favor of the motion.
Okay. Alan Friedman, abstain.
Tamara McCants, in favor of the motion.
James Appleby, abstain.
Daphne Bernard in favor of the motion. Motion carries. The minutes are approved. The next item on the agenda, it looks like we have no consent agenda to go over. And just for the record, we do have a quorum for any kind of business that has to be handled during our open session meeting. We'll start with our report from the executive director. So, Dr. Ortiz.
Yes. Good morning. So, I'm going to be giving the executive director report in place of Dr. White. We start off with some statistics. So as far as licensure for pharmacists, we have 2,250 pharmacist licenses, pharmacists with vaccination and immunization agent license. We have 695. For pharmacy interns, we have 623. Pharmacy technician training program, there are 10. For pharmacy technicians, we have 1,089. For pharmacy technician trainee, there are 98. And for pharmaceutical detailers, we have 750. So kind of moving into the new licensing portal. So as you know, we have a new licensing portal that just started and is live for pharmacists and pharmacy technicians. So far, we have about 40% of our pharmacists who have renewed, as well as our technicians. We have about 40% as well, so about 399 technicians and 928 pharmacists. So the new licensing portal is a switch for us. So we're gonna it's going well so far. So we just want to make sure that everyone is renewing their license. So we sent out an email blast a few days ago. So go ahead and review that. And then on the bottom there's a link that you can click on, and that will allow you to renew. Please go over the first page. The first page has a lot of information on how to register and get your license renewed. Some big changes are that there are no longer going to be any more paper applications. So this is all online, and you'll receive an email license rather than a printed out license that would be mailed to you previously. So, and some things just to note: you want to make sure you're using Chrome or Firefox. The Explorer or Edge will not allow you to upload your CEs. And if you have issues when you're renewing, just go into the frequently asked questions page, and that'll kind of help you get through any issues that you have. So once you submit your application and pay, you should receive your license within 5 to 10 minutes, unless you have selected yes for certain questions. So some questions, as far as like if you may have been arrested or if you had some CEs that you need to complete before you finish your application, that will kind of hold your application up, and it will be manually reviewed. But you should receive that within 3 days. And if you do not, just go ahead and put in a case in the portal, and that will allow you to allow us to look over your look over and see what issues there are. So next we have the update on the CPR training. So it's more of a clarification rather than an update. So we want to make sure that the CPR training is live or in person, just so that pharmacists can perform CPR properly, and that district residents as well as veterans are able to receive this if needed. So as far as the CPR, just make sure you have your documentation of your certification along with the CE requirements. And if you aren't able to keep your CPR certification active throughout licensure, just let us know, because we can inactivate your license. We want people to keep their CPR training, but their vaccination and immunization license, but if you can't keep the training up, please let us know, and that could be done via fax. And as well with the renewal portal, there's an option to, on the last page, if you uncheck the payment for your vaccination immunization agent license, then that will cause it to go on hold. So next, we have the prescription drug monitoring program, which is continuing to go strong. We encourage everyone to register. We have some legislation that is pending to be passed for prescribers and dispensers to have mandatory registration. So I suggest that everyone goes ahead and registers now. It's not too much. It's a very quick process, so just go ahead and register. There'll be some more information at the end of your renewal, there will be a link to go to the PDMP. And we'll have more correspondence as far as the mandatory registration coming out soon. Next, the opioid strategic plan, which is Live Long on Sea, that was released by the mayor in December. The plan is a strategy that the district has in place to reduce opioid misuse and abuse. As you may know, that the DC's opioid issue is a little different than a lot of other states. So it has 7 goals that kind of target through cross-discipline private and public sector coalitions. So if you want more information on that, you can go to the DBH website. Make sure you sign up for the PDMP. That's the way to help with the opioid strategic plan. have an update for the clinical lab practitioner advisory committee. So yesterday we met to discuss the pending regulations. So we kind of just went through the regulations and clarified any issues or anything that was omitted. So that we plan to have a committee member come to the next meeting and present to give a little more information on the regulations. So last up, I have the naloxone update. So early December, we sent out some information about the naloxone standing order as part and the policy statement. So the policy statement basically stated that NPOs or national pharmacy organizations can create their own training program as well as have a physician sign the standing order for them. And then for non-NPOs or independent pharmacies, they can go ahead and have a standing order through DC Health. One of our physicians will sign off on it for them. So if you have any questions about that, you can reach out to me. And so far, we have about six independent pharmacies that have signed up. So we have Good Care Pharmacy, Oregon Pharmacy, Calorama Pharmacy, as well as the three Brooks locations, Northeast, Northwest, and Southeast. That's about all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ortiz, for that very informative update. So we have some questions.
Can you repeat that, the last thing that you stated about the pharmacies that signed up for what? What did they sign up for?
For the naloxone standing order.
To be able to
dispense naloxone pursuant to a standing order.
So there's a process where they need to sign up if they're interested in?
Yeah, so they would reach out to me and they would make sure they do the training, so that the training through DCRX with naloxone, and then we will sign up on the standing order and return that back to them.
So hopefully the members in our public members kind of heard that and you're aware of what that process is if you're interested in.
That's what I was going to say, Don's water. You have a quiet, fast voice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I don't know about everybody else, but it was hard for me to hear a lot of that stuff. I was going to ask if you would please repeat, number one, the data at the very beginning where you have number of pharmacists registered. And the other question I also wanted to ask you about was the prescription monitoring program where registration is mandatory. Who is mandatory?
It's for dispensers and prescribers and dispensers, so pharmacists.
All prescribers, all dispensers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And can you repeat those other numbers, please?
So the numbers, so which numbers as far as renewals or just total pharmacists?
Yeah, probably
just go through the list if you could.
Okay, so for pharmacists, we have 2,250 pharmacists registered in D.C. right now. Pharmacists with vaccination and immunization agent licenses, there's 695. Pharmacy interns, there's 623. For pharmacy technician training programs, there are 10. Pharmacy technicians, there are 1,089. Pharmacy technician trainees, there are 98. And for pharmaceutical detailers, there are 750. As far as the renewal, right now we have 928 pharmacists who have renewed. And for the technicians, we have 399.
Thank you.
No problem.
Yes. Some questions. Dr. Ortiz, thank you for the report. I have several questions. So the due date for license renewal is when?
February 28th.
And is that for pharmacists and technicians?
Yes.
Okay. Secondly, the CPR training and that it needs to be live. I know that Maryland recently made a change to also align with that, and they've communicated that. Is this something new for us, or are you just reinforcing what's already in place? And if it's new, how are we communicating that?
It's just a clarification. So it's something that's already in place.
Already in place.
A clarification.
Okay. And then regarding the PDMP, thank you for talking about that. So just to make sure everybody's clear, there's a difference between encouraging pharmacists to sign up for it and mandating. And I do believe now that the requirement is going to be that dispensers and prescribers have to sign up, and for pharmacists, it's by the end of March.
The date, I'm not sure.
I've seen it in writing. It is, right, the end of March that they have to sign up. So I just want to make sure that, I was wondering what the plan is to communicate that, because we're almost mid-February. Is that part of licensing, or will that be clear?
Yeah,
Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Justin. Just to clarify on a few things with the PDMP. So that legislation is going through the congressional review. I believe the mayor signed off on it. We have the congressional review period. It's written that the mandatory date is March 31st. We're not really sure that the legislation will actually be in effect by then, and everyone will be taking that into consideration as far as enforcement. Right now, the biggest enforcement mechanism is that you won't be allowed to renew your license or obtain a new license if you have not registered. More so than assessing penalties, you just won't get to have a license in D.C. And when we say prescribers, it's really focused at prescribers that can prescribe controlled substances, because when you renew, you also renew your controlled substance registration, and then I believe it's going to hopefully be set up where it will take you to the PDMP portal to also sign up at that point. We're trying to make that nice and seamless for everyone. So the legislation has the March 31st date for everybody. That's required. All dispensers and prescribers of controlled substances. That is the date that will be in the law. However, as far as enforcement, there may be some flexibility by the boards on that. All the boards will be pushing that out. I think the Board of Medicine, they just finished a renewal, unfortunately, so they have plans in the works to make sure they get all their information out. So the boards and the department staff will be working together to push that information out to the licensees and make sure that everyone's getting registered so that no one incurs any type of sanctions. There are other sanctions other than not being able to renew, but that's the biggest stick for that provision. As far as the CPR policy statement, seeing it as a policy statement was a first for me, so I do want to follow up with Shauna to see the intention there. We did vote at a previous meeting. I don't recall if it was January or December. There was a question that came in from a member of the pharmacy community asking about that. The board voted that its interpretation is that it's a live CPR. So I do think it's a good idea that we put a policy statement up on our website. Those are prepared by me, so if that's something that the board and the program would like for me to do, I can get that put together for your review at our next meeting. And then lastly, I did want to touch up on the clinical lab person. I'm also advisor for that committee, met with them last night, and they're planning to come to the April meeting. That's our next public meeting, and it's to discuss legislation and regulations, so that has to be a public session meeting. So they won't be here in March, they'll be here in April. And one of the things they want to talk about is making some changes to that law. It's an old law, and some things have changed in the practice. So what we are doing, I'm going to have draft legislation prepared for them to bring to you and recommend to you some tweaks to the legislation.
Thank you, Carla. I knew the mayor had signed off on the 31st of January. I just wasn't sure how the congressional, that 30-day period, was going to affect the timeline. So that's good to know. And then lastly, with regard to PDMP, when one goes to sign up, there's a question about DEA number. And the way I read it was it would be the personal DEA number, so I'm assuming that's when the prescriber signs up. So they put their DEA number. Then when you look further, it says, I guess it's for the pharmacist, the DEA number. I'm assuming that's the pharmacy that the pharmacist is associated with. Now, I'm told that one can actually go past that and leave it blank. And if you do that, you get access to PDMP, but it's read-only. And so I guess if you're and there's a message that says you're not associated with a pharmacy. So the direction would be that if you're working in a pharmacy, you put the pharmacy DEA number. If you're a clinical pharmacist, it may not be. You can still get read-only access because you wouldn't have a pharmacy DEA number. Is that right, Dr. Ortiz?
I can get back to you on that.
Okay.
I'm not, from my understanding, that the DEA number is required.
Okay.
It shouldn't watch your access, but let me get back to you.
Yeah, so it would be good to know if there's a difference between read-only for pharmacists who do or do not use a stored DEA number.
And just along that line, and I do see your hand, if you could also just check, because if that's the current way the system is, perhaps depending on what your answer is in terms of if you're a prescriber or your pharmacist and what setting you're in, then it can make it mandatory that you do have to enter. Like if I'm a pharmacist and I work in the retail setting, it should not be optional for me to not include the pharmacy's DEA number if the intent is for me as a pharmacist in that retail setting to have more than read-only access. I'm simply suggesting that I just take a look at how the system is structured so that questions that really need to be answered, you're kind of making, we can make sure that those are answered. I'm sorry, Jenna.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question regarding the license renewals. So my understanding is that the DC website still has the current expiration date once you renew. Do you know when the new license expiration date will update? Just because from an employer standpoint, it's really important for employers to know when their pharmacist and technician.
Oh, you want me to speak? Oh, sure. So what we've noticed, like at the very beginning, it was kind of slow updating, but as of right now, it updates either a day or two after.
Mm-hmm. I updated in early January, and same with him. So mm-hmm. we had our paper one, but it's not updated for several weeks.
Okay, I can say this. Some people are using the old online license search, and we have a new online license search that will reflect the new expiration date, and I can forward that to you if you like, and I can get with you after the meeting. And that's what I'm finding out. People have saved the old online renewal search, and that's why there is not updating online.
Is that a bookmark issue then?
Sorry?
If somebody has a
bookmark issue, yes.
Exactly.
So I search for the link.
Does it say DC Health at the top?
I'm not sure.
It's okay, because right, it's
it doesn't look different from the previous years. So the layout or something has changed.
Right, it's a different layout, and it could be that you're using the old online license search module. So I can forward it to you if you like. We can speak up in the meeting.
Google searching for it and it's still coming up.
Right. But what you can do, you can also send me that link so I can have it removed as well.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. This is why we kind of need input from individuals who are kind of out there and experiencing these things. Mm-hmm. If you can kind of look into that, and if there is a old link that's still live, mm-hmm. we either need IT to redirect
exactly.
to the new link or embed in the old one or something. But if you can kind of follow up on that,
sure,
that
no
would
problem.
Be awesome. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I guess if there's something you want to post so that individuals who need to go to the new site, I would prefer, I think it's more efficient if the new link is posted as opposed to or in addition to emailing the proper information to the individuals. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are 100 people who aren't in the meeting today that want to get to the
right.
meeting.
I was going to suggest, based on what you're telling me, we can look into updating our FAQs and then also updating our DC Board of Pharmacy's website.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Right now, technicians are able to renew, but pharmacists are stuck. I had three on the phone with me this morning that said they just can't do it, and they're submitting cases, and no one's returning them. So they weren't returning, like, they were asking, do I just need to go in person, but I'm having so much trouble.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I understand that we're currently going through all the cases right now because we get them daily,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. But again, just let me know and we'll follow up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're
when
welcome.
Somebody submits a case, do they get an auto-generated just to acknowledge email and that someone will be back in touch with you within 48 hours or whatever, or just nothing?
Nothing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. At first I wasn't able to renew, and then I called, and I finally got in touch with somebody, and she was super helpful.
And she connected me to everybody all at once. But I submitted
several cases, and I didn't get anything.
So, thank you for the update. This is wonderful input from the public, and I just would encourage all of you to continue to hammer away at any pharmacist you may interact with to say, get on license renewal now. If only 40% of license have renewed so far, and we've got 3 weeks to get the last 60% in, we know from historical assessments of individual practitioners' success at completing their 40 hours of required CE that many don't complete their CE. The new system that requires the uploading of your CE profile is going to be a shock to many people. And so we could have a pretty unpleasant situation in the next 21 days, and in particular the last week. So I would encourage us to think about additional messaging. The messages that have come out from the Department of Health have been very comprehensive. And sometimes comprehensive is good, and sometimes comprehensive means people don't actually read what's there. So there might be some additional messaging we want to do. There are three key bullet points to get their attention and say, do this, be aware of that. 21 days and counting. I don't know what it is, but I'm afraid if we don't get the attention of the individuals involved, it's just going to be a problem, because these folks are really going to realize, oh my gosh, I have to go out and actually fulfill my CE requirements before time.
Mm-hmm.
And the requirement around cultural competence is not a simple one to comply with. It's not easy to find those out there. They're certainly not free, for example, and other requirements. I think we should hammer away again and again so that we don't have a crush on the 28th of this month.
So you actually stole a little bit of my thunder from the communications subcommittee.
Oh,
but,
well,
yeah,
you can improve upon it, I'm sure.
I think those points are excellent. What we're recommending is a series of email blasts, because the point about the CEs is very important. There still is time to complete those, and you guys probably hear this at some of the meetings that have gone on. Remember, we do an audit every year. Many of us get audited. It's a random pick, and if you're randomly picked, you have to submit your evidence. But every year, there are lots of people who have not completed their required CEs. And so I think it's really helpful now for us to send out a couple of reminders to people that, hey, you still have a couple of weeks to go ahead and complete those CEs, especially because there are individuals who are having trouble finding the LGBTQ CEs, and honestly, I have not found one yet that is free. They do have it on Pharmacist Letter, but Pharmacist Letter isn't free. So the point is, we definitely need to get that out there, so I'm glad that you brought that point up. I thought I saw another hand in the audience. No? Okay. All right. Anything else? All right. Well, thank you so much. That was a good discussion. We're going to move to the next item on our agenda, and that's the Assistant General Counsel's report. But I see that there's nothing new. Is there an update there?
No, I have nothing new to add.
Okay. Thank you. So now we'll go into our subcommittee reports, and we'll start with Alan.
The representatives from the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine have their next meeting planned to talk about next steps related to pharmacists prescribing hormonal contraception in the District of Columbia. That meeting, I think, right now is scheduled for next Wednesday afternoon. And so at that meeting, we'll be going through the patient self-assessment. I've completed the next draft of that, and then also the pharmacist referral form. I should have that done today, and then the physicians are going to be working on the algorithm based on the self-assessment, and then I think we're going to have a conversation around pharmacists and patient education. We'll come perhaps with some recommendations from the pharmacy perspective, but the committee as a whole has to come to agreement or consensus on what the committee's recommendation is going to be around education, to bring that back to the respective boards. And we have draft regulations put together. There's still an opportunity for the committee members to provide some feedback on that before we'll then share with the full boards. The only thing I would say is that I won't be able to be at that meeting because it wasn't one of the dates and time periods that I had given availability when there was outreach for that, but that was the time that Frank selected. So, Ben, are you going to be there?
I will.
So, if you don't mind, and I'll send the next draft of the documents out to the whole group, and I don't know if maybe you would have time, just like 30 minutes, we could talk over the phone between now and then, and
sure.
I can just share with you what was done and why and what wasn't done and why, and if you want to convey that to the group.
Okay.
And then I can just give you my perspective on a couple of outlier things, obviously wherever the group wants to go with it, if that's helpful, because then maybe there won't be some questions.
I may be able to join via WebEx or call for the last part of the meeting, and I'm happy to do that if that's helpful. So I'll get all that over to you hopefully by Friday.
Okay.
Any questions from the board about where we are there?
Helen, what is that meeting scheduled for? What day?
It's a committee meeting next week, middle of next week.
You said Wednesday.
Wednesday afternoon, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Any other updates from the legislative and regulatory outstanding subcommittee?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, all right, thank you. So that's a good segue to the communication subcommittee. Our next edition of our state newsletter, the content will be submitted next week. And so we're currently putting that information together. There are a couple of things that Shauna wants to include to make sure that our pharmacists and technicians are aware of. The other thing is regarding the email communications that we're going to verb. There, I think the plan is and the recommendation is for a couple of email blasts to go out to our wonderful pharmacists, just reminding them of a few things. You know, there's a new system, what the deadline is for renewal, and then just really encouraging everyone to please be extra certain that you've met the 40 CE hours and those specific required hours, the number that have to be live, those that, you know, that have to be with medication errors, those in HIV, those in LGBTQ cultural competency. And there still is time, and so that's the good news, but we definitely need to get the word out and just have people just double check. Because if it's a new renewal, then it's going to be really important that you're able to properly provide that documentation if needed. And I think that's pretty much it. So we're preparing our newsletter, and then we'll have these email blasts to go out about the upcoming renewal. Questions? Comments? Community members, I always remind you, if there are things that you think the community, and when I say community, I mean our colleagues, the pharmacists, technicians, and detailers, can't forget them, that could really benefit from certain, from a better discussion or a better understanding around certain things that we can include in the newsletter, by all means, you can let me know, let Shauna know, and I think everyone knows how to get in touch with Corinne, but any kind of topics that you are particularly interested in having covered, then we'd love to hear those. Okay? Any questions? All right. We will now move to our next item on the agenda, and that is the summary of the NABPE news. And we will have, and I apologize, Summer. I remember you. I'm sorry. Summer Muckle is going to give us a presentation, an update on e-news. So,
thank you so much. Again, good morning, everyone. My name is Summer Muckle. I'm a fourth-year doctor of pharmacy candidate at Howard University College of Pharmacy. And today, I'm just going to be going over a few of the topics that caught our attention that you need to know about the world of pharmacy. So some of the topics include the FDA updating policies in terms of outsourcing facilities. We will talk about one of the intergovernmental international meetings that was held in order to strategize as a way to find ways to combat this opioid crisis that's not only U.S. affiliated, but international. We will go over a study that looks at the trends of opioid prescriptions in the pediatric population in emergency departments. And then we will talk about how the FDA is fast-tracking the production of naloxone to become an over-the-counter product. So with the first update, first, what is an outsourcing facility? So your outsourcing facility is different from your normal compounders in the fact that they can do two things. They can distribute to patient-specific patients, but then they can also distribute compounded prescriptions to non-patient-specific patients. So in that particular situation, you're looking at your hospitals, your medical offices that are asking for these compounded medications just to be on hand in case they need it for various procedures, et cetera, et cetera. In addition to these two different ways they can compound prescriptions, they don't have a true quantity limit on how much of that compounded prescription they can dispense. And they have to report all of adverse effects or anything that can happen with this compounded prescription to the FDA, which your normal compounding pharmacies truly don't have to do. So with this update, the update comes to the current good manufacturing processes. The guidance is 503B, Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And pretty much the revision is going to allow us to understand the true differences between your normal compounding pharmacies and your outsourcing facilities. They will provide more clarity on quality, the sterility, stability testing, beyond use dates, and things of that nature. And it's also going to give you more information on how feasible it can be to register your traditional compounders to your outsourcing facility. The next is about the meeting that was held in Vienna, Virginia, if I recall correctly. And it was intergovernmental. It was three different agencies that was there: the UNODC, which is the United Nations Office of Drug and Crime, the UINCB, which is the International Narcotics Control Board, and WHO, which is the World Health Organization. So pretty much they wanted to talk about some of the things that have been done in terms of the opioid epidemic in the U.S. So the U.S. in the past year allotted at least $4 billion in terms of research and treatment prevention, more surveillance, giving support to our law enforcement agencies so that they can track and actually get these people off the street, and then just enhancing the resources for diversion. But what one thing that came up during the meeting is the fact that internationally, this is also a problem. And some or most of the transactions that are being made with any synthetic opioids is coming through the dark web, which a lot of people don't know about. But the dark web is there. Not everyone has access to it. It's a very encrypted system, but this is how many of the transactions are being processed, especially with the explosion of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. That's how the transactions are going through. What we also know is that there are at least 850 synthetic drugs out there. And they're saying that 1 to 2 are being released every week. So the upcoming strategies wanted to implement the UNODC's toolkit. And the use of the toolkit is pretty much giving these countries the technical assistance they need in order to implement anything that needs to be updated with their infrastructure to make sure that they can handle the capabilities. They wanted to get enhanced cooperation with these private sectors. So that's including your pharmaceutical companies, chemists, medical offices, just so they can understand what's going on those particular levels as the main in the manufacturing process. They want to provide some type of education to the community so that they can understand that the internet is not just Google or Firefox, but there is also the dark web as well. And you just need to be cautious in the things that you're doing on the internet before you cross one of those paths. We wanted to help the law enforcement agencies in these countries be able to better track the shipments of these particular synthetic opioids, because that's probably the main issue right now, because it can be transferred in so many ways, through air, boat, train, bus, any way you can think of. They want to be able to have a better hold on what's going on in their countries. And then public health education in general, more prevention and treatment strategies, and just letting the communities know the things that they can do to help, but that this is a serious crisis that everyone needs to watch out for. Keeping on the track of opioid prescribing, this particular study wanted to look at the trends in the pediatric population, and specifically the emergency department. So the research question that they had was, how has opioid use in pediatric patients changed over the past 10 years, and what are the factors associated with it? So this is a cross-sectional study that was done, and they looked at data from the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey from January 1st of 2005 to December 31st of 2015. December 31st of 2015. And so when they were looking at the data from this survey, they were really digging through these health records to see the patients that were 18 years and younger. They were looking at some of the symptoms that they came in with, the diagnoses, race, any other demographic information such as insurance that they were using, medications that were prescribed during their time at the emergency room, and any prescriptions that were prescribed at discharge. From there, they used the CDC New Ambulatory Care database to discern from opioid medications and other medications. And from there, what they saw was that there were 69,000 visits by patients that were younger than 18 between 2006 and 2015, with 32,000 of them being female patients. And they noticed that there were a variety of different factors that truly affected how these opioids were being prescribed, from your race to your region to the insurance that you were using to get these particular prescriptions. And so although there was a decline in the number of opioid prescriptions that were prescribed to these specific populations from 2010, with it being like 8.3% to 6.2% in 2015, what they noticed was that there wasn't any consistency with the opioid prescribing. So the solution for this particular study, or what they want to implement, is pretty much a guidance to give more of an educated, or to have the physician make a more educated decision when prescribing these opioids in terms of the pediatric population. But they also want to make an overall guidance so that on a standard level that we all understand why these opioids are being prescribed, what they're being prescribed for, and how they monitor. And so then lastly, on January 17th of this year, the FDA pretty much announced that they want to make naloxone an over-the-counter product. And they are fast-tracking this by doing something that they truly don't do for other over-the-counter products, which is make a drug fact label. The drug fact label, as you know, if you look at any over-the-counter product, it's that black and white label that gives you all the product-specific information, the warnings, precautions, storage, the indication, and most importantly, the directions for use. So these are the two model drug fact labels that they have produced for the naloxone, one being for the nasal spray, which is Narcan, and then one being for the auto-injector, which is the FDO. So from these model drug fact labels, they have actually tested them within a population of 700, ranging from your adults to adolescents, persons that are opioid users, family and friends of these users, just to make sure that they will be able to understand how to use the medication in the emergency situation. And with the resounding approval, everyone understood the pictograms. They were able to administer the medication as described. So literally the only thing that needs to be done by manufacturers is them including the product-specific information. Everything else, the layout, this is how the product would look. So, in the very near future, you could see naloxone being over-the-counter with your Tylenol and ibuprofen very soon. That's the end of the presentation. I thank you so much for your time. Is there any questions? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Questions. Mm-hmm. Great job.
Thank you.
Questions?
Questions?
Yes. What are your thoughts about this apparent push for the use of naloxone as opposed to the pharmacist's role in identifying and helping patients manage substance use?
So it's twofold. I really do think that everyone needs to have access to naloxone just because it has shown to be extremely effective in reversing the effects of an overdose. I just think it's really hard for the pharmacist at this point, depending on what setting you're in. If I think about a retail setting, it could be kind of challenging to take time from your daily tasks, which you know you already have, to find that time to make sure that you're truly counseling your patients. And I can say that because I work in a retail setting already, and I see the struggle that the pharmacist has between their daily task and wanting to speak to the patient about certain things. But I also think that there's a stigma around this whole situation, which makes it a little harder to reach out to those patients because they might not necessarily want to talk to you. Which is why I think having this as an over-the-counter product, you take away that stigma a little bit because you don't necessarily have to talk to me about anything. If you see the product and you have a question, I will talk to you. However, you don't necessarily have to come to the pharmacy and say, "Hey, can I get the naloxone because I need it?" Which typically is what happens. They whisper. They don't really want to know. They really don't want people to know why they're there. So, it's a twofold. I really wish we could devote more time to patient education. This is what you need to look out for. Things of that nature. However, I also think that making this a priority with increasing the visibility and access to naloxone would be a good thing.
Question. Because we have some great people who are in community pharmacy. What's it called? If we make this over-the-counter, what's going to be the cost around it?
Ask the drug company.
Does anybody have an idea? I mean,
it's really expensive.
Yes.
There are some generic versions, but they're injections. It's not auto-injector. The auto-injector and the nasal are pretty pricey.
Like, we're talking about $100?
$70+.
For one?
Yes. One's a butt that has two doses in it.
So if we make it over-the-counter, can people's insurance pay for it, or no?
No.
It depends. Some Medicaid, yeah, those will cover.
Yeah, right. Just like currently there are like OTC products.
And then you process it like that, and then the insurance covers it.
But they would still need a prescription in order to make that happen, which, you know, could either come
that benefit
standing order if that organization has one, or from a good guy.
So there are some government plans or government directives that will cover OTCs, certain OTCs, that we talk about Medicaid, mm-hmm. but not other OTCs. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you're right. I mean, if there's certain OTCs that are written as an RX, it may be covered under commercial insurance, but not if it's just bought as an OTC. Yeah. And it's interesting, your question, because, you know, that thought of more of a proactive pharmacist consultation role in terms of managing as opposed to reacting to, right? And then a lot of things that are OTC maybe don't require as much counseling.
Right.
Certain things do. So it's a catch-22, because on the one hand you want to make it readily available because you don't want people to be embarrassed and to not ask for it. On the other hand, if people aren't using it correctly and don't take advantage of the pharmacist consultation, it may not work the way that it should in its most advantageous way. So there's a lot of education that needs to be a component of it, of its use, I think.
Yes?
I do have a comment in response to you stating that, you know, you work in a retail environment and see how difficult that is and the stigma. I think as healthcare providers, that it's our responsibility to help break down those stigmas. And, I mean, you're a pharmacy student. You're young. You're in it. You know, there is no better time for the generation of younger pharmacists than passionate professionals like myself now, even, to say to the organizations and the companies, this is a priority. We have to be proactive about this and not let volume of prescriptions override what our real goal as pharmacists really are.
Right. Like, along those lines, like, if we are at the frontline practitioners and we already talking about what we don't have time to do, we're part of the problem. Like, the access to naloxone over the counter is going to be a barrier to the most underserved or at-risk population, because it's going to increase the amount of money that's going to pay for it, the bureaucracy to get it. You're still going to need a prescription anyway. And pharmacists have to be comfortable about having those type of conversations surrounding substance abuse, period. Because if we're not as a frontline practitioner, then who's going to do it? So we have representatives from all of, you know, the retail companies here. What is the balance between managing your staff or managing the workload of the pharmacist so they can truly practice clinically? And also, what are we not doing as pharmacy schools to prepare our students, future practitioners, to properly manage their staff so that they can do what they need to do clinically?
Great job, Summer. In some jurisdictions, it's required to report the difference in the awesome treatment fee. Did you happen to find any conversations about maybe behind the counter OTC products, or
Monet, could you?
Sorry. So in some jurisdictions, it's required to report naloxone to the CDMG. So were there any conversations where naloxone would be a behind-the-counter product so that they could be compliant with that requirement?
When you say over-the-counter, behind the like behind-the-counter, over-the-counter, like your Sudafeds and things of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the research that I did prior to, no, but I don't mind searching other states to see what they have going on, because it hasn't been so recent that you've had a resounding at least 48 states participating in having the naloxone standing order and having the pharmacies being able to dispense it without a prescription. So all of this is still in the works. Who knows? It might not become an over-the-counter product just because of some of the discussion we've been having here. I don't mind looking to see what other states have been doing.
Monet, are our neighboring jurisdictions that you're aware of, Maryland and Virginia, asking for the reporting of naloxone? No?
I'm thinking of some jurisdictions that are on the West Coast. I think I remember one of the statistics was from a jurisdiction, and he said that the prescribing was higher on the West Coast. So
I think it might be Maryland that but it's voluntary reporting. I don't think it's required, so I don't know how many people then follow through on it.
I wonder what's the rationale for that.
I know. Well, this, first of all, outstanding presentation.
Thank you.
Outstanding.
Standing.
You did a wonderful job. Sparks further discussion, because honestly, I think we could sit and talk about this for the next 3 hours, because there are some things to talk about. But what's important? A couple of things. One, people are dying every single day. I mean, I remember at one of the national pharmacy meetings, president of one of their boards, his son, unfortunately died from one of these opioid overdoses. Another, national? I think she's like one of the national officers. Her daughter's friend teenagers hanging out, for whatever reason, someone went outside, the young man was in the driveway, dead, had died of an overdose, and the friends didn't know what to do, so they put him in the car, took him home, and dropped him off in his driveway. Here's my point. Even though there are some serious conversations that we just need to frankly have. I was going to ask you to put a slide up on the thing again, but I won't do it. There are several things that are at play. Some of it in terms of all these billions of dollars that are being thrown out there. You got to ask yourself, what percentage of that is going to the people and the patients versus going to diversion and better electronic ways of having borders. And now, don't get me wrong, those things are important as well, but the point is we care about people and we're concerned about some of the people issues, and we need to make sure that that's also at the forefront of what's behind this opioid crisis that we're experiencing. But the important thing is there are ways that we may be able to save one life, and there are ways definitely that pharmacists can be a valuable part of the conversation. So the fact that we are still talking about it, I think, is a step in the right direction. But again, I really thank you for that presentation. I got a feeling you're not going to stop looking into some of these questions and some of this great research that you found out. And I wish we could have you back again, but I guess our rotation's ready.
Have you back again?
Okay. Thank you. All right. Great job. All right. All right, so we will move on to the next item. I'm gonna go ahead and, instead of the newsletter part for the sake of time, I think you've kind of seen and some of the things that are, you see the issues going on with Valsartan. There are some other Valsartan products that are now, that have been recalled. I did also just want to point out the issue with the lots of ceftriaxone injection. Make sure that you know that some of those lots are being recalled as well. I think those are the main thing. For the students in the room, the 2019 Survey of Pharmacy Law is now available. That information, I think it usually costs almost $200 to get, but for pharmacy students, you get it for free. So make sure that you get that, so when you prepare to take your law exams, you're up to date. And there are three new areas that are on the Survey of Pharmacy Law, including medical marijuana. So make sure you review that information. I think that's pretty much the biggest thing that I just wanted to point out from the newsletter. You can get this newsletter information electronically as well. All right, so if it's okay, we can move on to the next item, which is matters for consideration for the board. So item 05, and this is really looking at the collaborative agreements and where we are, kind of continuing the conversation from what Alan provided earlier. So there's an, I don't know, am I presenting this or is this something that should come up from you or from? Okay, 05. So basically, it was kind of what we were talking about a little while earlier. So with the collaborative agreement, remember, this has been a joint process, a joint endeavor, a joint journey, quite frankly, between the Board of Medicine and the Board of Pharmacy. And we've made a lot of headway. The regulations have been published, put in place. We're just working around, you know, making some adjustments based on additional feedback that we continue to get, especially from the community. So right now, based on the current regulations, collaborative practice will be allowed based on protocols, okay? So if there's a protocol that's
align with what is typically considered standard practice in these protocols, you know, anticoagulant management, diabetes management, IVDPO switch, those kind of things. If it's standard, then those things don't have to necessarily go through a deep review by the either boards. But if you're submitting a protocol that's outside of what is considered standard, then that means the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine have to come together and review those and decide whether or not that will be allowed. And so at this time, what we are doing is putting together a small task force that will have two members from each board, Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine, to just sit down and lay out what that review process will look like if and when they have to come together to review these things that are kind of beyond what is considered standard. Does that make sense, everybody? So again, I don't know how many of these protocols will come before the body, but when they do come, it is a good idea to have in place a process for review that we'll need to undergo. So there are two members from our Board of Pharmacy who we would like to volunteer to be on this task force. And so that's what I present before you, board colleagues. Any volunteers?
I'd like to volunteer to serve on the task force.
Thank you.
I would also be happy to volunteer.
That is awesome and amazing. Thank you very much. And so we will provide that information and let the Board of Medicine know that we have two outstanding board members that'll work in this endeavor. So, hey, workflows. I know for those in the audience who've been following collaborative practice agreement for a while, thank you for your patience. But look, we are closer today than we were yesterday, so that's a good thing. Okay, any questions? Comments? Okay. All right, so now we will have a verbal report on DC pharmacy robberies from Mr. Lawrence Holland. And so are you comfortable there, or do you need to come up front, or you're okay?
I think I'm exactly my projector voice.
Okay,
here.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
What I wanted to bring to you all was a flash of robbery.
I can't hear you.
One burglary that we've been having throughout the city as it pertains to our pharmacies. We've had four robberies, one burglar, no injuries in any of the robberies, and drug of choice that's been taken has been formidably with codeine, as we all expect. The robberies transpired between the dates of November 29th, 2018, until the last one, which was January 27th, 2019. That first robbery, that was kind of towards the time where in law enforcement what we consider to be like robbery season. It's right before Christmas. And so during that time frame, we did a lot of robberies of establishments. But as we understand it, the pharmacy industry or whatever, it's just a little different. But during the time from right around Thanksgiving until Christmas, what we experienced when I was in Hornbeck office, but we experienced a rash of robberies. Higher what we're experiencing now in pharmacy. Thus, I'm bringing this information to you. And with the codeine, methadone codeine, that's where everything is transpiring. This, on the 29th, November 29th, the robbery was at Ramadas Pharmacy, which is located on Ingraham Street, 475 Ingraham Street, Northeast. And as I give you these addresses, it's throughout the city. So it's not like there's 51 quadrant in the city. They're just picking areas where they think they can be most, it can be most advantageous towards them. We had three unarmed mass suspects in the pharmacy at this particular robbery. One suspect immediately accosted the clerk, while the other two jumped over the counter and demanded fentanyl and codeine. The staff complied with the demands, and suspects made off with three bottles of that. This led to this particular unarmed. Go through all the information, guys. Have any questions? The board has any questions in reference to these robberies.
Wait, when are you taking questions? At the end?
At the end.
Okay, go ahead. Can you speak up? Okay.
Sure. Okay. Come back. And December 4th, this was one of the more violent robberies that we had. It was at Palisade Pharmacy on MacArthur Boulevard in Northwest. The suspect entered the pharmacy, and he eventually went behind the counter and he took a shotgun and put to the pharmacist in charge head. He demanded OxyContin, and he got the drugs that he wanted at that particular time. Crazy thing about this particular incident, he had his Uber driver wait outside. He got in the Uber. Police eventually caught this guy, and that robbery was closed. So it was, while it was quite scary, I'm quite sure, for the pharmacist, I just didn't understand the Uber, right? But he's off the street, this particular guy. On January 2nd, we had a burglary at Shepherd Pharmacy. Shepherd Pharmacy was broken into. There was no, the store was not occupied. It was a burglary. It was not a robbery. And when it went in, what was taken mostly was prescription, payment records and pending prescriptions to be filled. So we sent out a few alerts just so. What the police are going to find is the police think that this was a homeless individual because it was random. And he came in, he took over-the-counter drugs and just went back out. This pharmacy, Shepherd Pharmacy, has been relocated to this location. So it's not a really secure location. It's more like a home. It's like a house. And he just put unsecured doors and everything. And the person broke in. They didn't have deadbolt locks and was able to make off with. He didn't get in a safe. Didn't get any controlled substances. And he just took, for the most part, the biggest thing that he took was the payment records and pending prescriptions to be filled. Why, we don't know. Talked to one of the detectives. He said he just believed this may have been a homeless guy just looking for something to do that particular night. This has no M.O. fits no M.O. of any of the robbers that we've encountered. January 15th, there was a robbery. Two masked suspects at Calorama Pharmacy, 841 Columbia Road, Northwest. Two suspects entered the pharmacy. One suspect gestured in his waistband as if he had, as if he was armed. Again, they demanded the methazine with codeine. Cashier complied, and they also wanted cash at this particular time. Usually, we don't find that to be one of the things that they ask for. They usually want codeine. And they get on, but this particular time he wanted cash, and he made out with that particular cash. January 27th, which was our last, we had two masked suspects enter the pharmacy area. They leaped over the counter, and what I'm finding with this leaping over the counter, I don't know how we can change it. I don't know how we can suggest it, but CVS is lowering the counters, and as you lower the counters, what you do is you make it more accessible to an individual that wants to get over the counter and get to you. You have a counter that's here. I'm coming over that counter quite easily. And in a lot of these instances, like the robbery that was on Minnesota Avenue, I see three guys coming in to the establishment, immediately jumping over, one behind the other. They go straight to the safe, they demand the safe, they are back out inside of the van. But in this instance, like most, what I'm finding is the employees are compliant. And that's the most important thing, that we get compliance. We don't have that one individual that feels like, okay, I can stop this. I can do something. The drugs aren't sure. And what we want to convey at DC Health is just to allow them to have what they want. Now, my law enforcement experience says there's a few things that you can do to help while you're doing this. Usually the individual's mask. What's not masked usually, sometimes, are their hands and their shoes. As much as you may not think the shoes don't help, the police, what they do, they end up doing a show up a lot of times. When they have these robberies or things of that happen, they'll do a show up maybe four blocks down the road. You are considering that there's no way that anybody would know anything, but they didn't pay attention to their shoes. They didn't pay attention to the fact that they were wearing the latest Jordans or something of that nature. And you were able to see that. Is it something that you can do? Maybe not, because you're afraid. But it's the small things and the show up that may help the police and say, you know what, I can recognize at least that because the person was masked. And there's no way you can really determine what or who this person was. I had one individual say, well, they were black males because I saw a dark colored hand. Can't really consider that because you saw a dark color hand and with black males. You know, certain things, their mask, is unknown, you know, what that person is. But, you know, you just want to give as much detail as possible. I'm not saying go above and beyond to try to identify anyone. What I'm saying is try to just get as much information as you can to the police. And in doing that, then what we want here at DC Health is within that 48 hours, notify us that what has transpired. We understand that you're itemizing the drugs that were taken, and we will give, you know, time for you all to get everything to us and just complete the Form 106. But that's what we need. I've given up a few other things that I would like you all to pay attention to. I need you all to do to reassess your security protocols. And maybe your security protocols are exactly what you want them to be, maybe not. I think, from my law enforcement experience, that it might behoove a lot of you all to have maybe an unarmed security guard, maybe towards the front of the store. However, back towards the pharmacy, if it's possible, that may be where you want security back towards that area. The reason being, that's what everyone's coming into your store for. They're coming into that area. That person will be more advantageous. But I want to try to let all you to reinforce being calm. It's a robbery. Try your best to stay calm and do exactly what the individual asks of you. There's no reason for you to just try to say, you know what, I'm going to be that person, that hero. Because at the end of the day, all of these drugs are insured. And we want you to understand that. Try to make mental notes of the robber's appearance as much as you possibly can, giving as much information as you can to the police so that we can take that same information when it comes to us, push out alerts so we can get it to the other pharmacies and hopefully get these individuals off the street. But those are some of the mental notes that I want to convey to you all. I don't know if you have any questions, but I want you all to stay safe as best as possible. But as soon as we get the information from you all, because it's very important, we disseminate it out to all of the pharmacies as soon as we possibly can. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question. Thank you for that report. I was just think we want to create environments where we deter as much as possible. Where there's a will, there's a way. And so someone's always trying to be one step ahead, and we have to be one step ahead. But I'm thinking about, you mentioned in particular a pharmacy that maybe doesn't have the proper security in place. In terms of our regulations, and I guess it would be more the Pharmacy Control Division side, I'm assuming that there are regulations in place. I don't know when they were last updated about minimum standards that have to be met for a pharmacy. So in terms of alarms or deadbolts or security, even thinking about some of our neighboring boards and how they've recently changed their regulations around alarms and, you know, when power goes out, they have to have a backup and stuff like that. But deadbolts and if you know, closing off waiting rooms and window security and so on and so forth. Do we have provisions like that in place? And if so, maybe it's been a long time since we visited that. Maybe we'd be due for a revisit.
It could be revisited. See, a lot of provisions are very broad, so definitely more.
It's more what I've read. It's more for the actual drugs themselves. That's trying to safeguard the safe to have to be mandated, and it has to be a time lock and things of that nature.
Right.
That's what it turns.
Right.
And I understand exactly what you're saying, but deterrence, as far as from my background, has always been, if I'm going to case the spot, the first thing I look for is, where's my resistance?
Where's the weakness?
You know, and if you have any resistance, if I go in and I see there's absolutely no security, this is an ideal location.
Right.
I mean, if the counters are here, I'm coming over that counter, and I'm coming quickly.
Right.
Because for the most part, everybody's getting out of your way, and they're going to get the drugs. But that's just my background, and make that suggestion that you get security, but I think it's a lot safer. Dr. Kance, I don't know.
What's the difference between a burglary and a robbery? And is there a specific time of day? Was there any pattern in terms of the time of day when people are running into the pharmacy?
Okay, robbery is a crime of force, a crime of violence, where burglary can be if it was occupied. This particular burglary was a second-degree burglary because it was unoccupied. But the robbery is taking something from at that particular time. It could be a robbery of fear. It could be just a robbery. Most of these, aside from one, was robbery of fear. Robbery of fear. A person's gestured as if he had a weapon. I'm going to take it as if he has a weapon. However, these burglaries, you have what, for the most part, the dwelling is unoccupied. The robbery is of a person because they can take money from any establishment, and the actual person was there. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Holland. It's very helpful. I would just observe, and I appreciate from a law enforcement and sort of prevention strategy, the issue of
the height of countertops. Mm. And I would just observe, though, that from the perspective of serving patients and helping people form a closer bond with the healthcare mm-hmm. professional they see most often, the pharmacist, that actually a lower counter perhaps helps a lot. So I want to sort of go on record as saying we've got to balance the
Absolutely.
Two. While I sense in the whole country there's this push towards security, towards perhaps more law enforcement as mm-hmm. a way to solve the issues of the day, I'm not sure that lower barriers aren't a more effective way to build the right sort of relationship you want with patients, perhaps as well as with neighboring countries. So I just wanted to sort of put that out there to be thoughtful about. I want to make sure that pharmacy personnel, pharmacists, technicians, store clerks are well protected. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I would not want to see anyone take away the idea that the call ought to be the solution is to build a much higher wall or barrier between the patients we're trying to serve and the healthcare professionals available.
And I understand, and that's not what I was trying to convey, to put it completely.
I know that.
I mean, the way I would envision it, around, for the most part, the pharmacists can come down and speak. I would like that area to be more accessible. And just so, what I'm looking at is trying to make it as safe as possible.
You were right on. Right. You've done it in a very balanced way. I just wanted to reinforce that.
Thank you.
Yes.
I don't know if the Board of Pharmacy dedicates for pharmacists, the new type of support that the Board of Pharmacy gives our pharmacists once they've been victims of some type of crime, exactly what we do for them, help them, or like the grief counseling. Mm-hmm.
What they have in the district, the Metropolitan Police Department has a victim assistance program, and if you've been victimized in any way, there's been crimes, they can assist you. Another little tidbit will help with the police department, most of you may not be aware of. It's called being placed on a special attention list. You can call your area districts, and you can do it now. It doesn't take that a crime has occurred. You can call, ask to be placed on the special attention list. If they put your store, your establishment on it, police officers from each shift will come past, and they will just come past the lot if that's what you ask for. But if you want to be a nuisance, what you do is say you want that officer to come in and speak to you. And that's all you have to do is ask. What it does, that officer's gotten out of the car, that car is there, he's visible, he's coming in. Hopefully this is happening on three different shifts. When that's happening, what you have is that visibility. That's all you really want, maybe just for that moment when the guys are just casing the spot outside. They'll say, you know what? I don't know when they're coming. And if that happens just for a moment, and that's all you have to do is call and ask to be placed based on the rash of robberies and based on this that we're going through with this opioid crisis. Ask for it. Ask for it. I mean, you pay your taxes, ask for it, and they'll come. And when they don't come, you call them and complain. Yeah.
I
have
a community
service
location. Do the trends seem like it was more independent? Or still want the local retail ones, but just different locations.
In these last, it was independent. However, since I've been here, there has been more CVS locations than the other one. I was talking to someone the other day. It's almost like an individual when they think about where to rob. That's the household name, CVS. Just comes in and they just try to go to those locations. But I do believe that those smaller pharmacies are more aggressive. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Just for clarification, so Mr. Holland, all of those that you mentioned were all independent pharmacies?
No, we had Walgreens towards the end.
Walgreens at the end?
Yes, that was the last pharmacy.
And then my second question, in terms of the times?
They vary. I was trying to look and see if they were coming towards, because Dr. White and I, we thought it was towards closing or opening. It just varied.
It can be in the middle of the day.
In the middle of the day. The one I went to on Mesa Avenue, CVS, middle of the day. Guys were just obviously plotting on the spot in the middle of the day and just went over the counter. I think it was maybe like one afternoon.
Okay. And then my last question is this. I was I ran into a colleague at the hospital who, both of his daughters went through pharmacy school and are doing well. And she works for a chain in D.C., I think she's in D.C. And a few months earlier, she had experienced a robbery because they put a gun to her head, and she's trying to. Their safe still have the combination, and she was taking a while to open it, and he was like screaming at her, and unfortunately, she screamed back at him, and she was like, "I'm trying to think. You have a gun pointing to my head." My point is, she actually used a dummy safe. And I never heard of that before. When I was in retail, we didn't have such a thing, but she used the dummy safe and gave him what he thought were drugs in a bottle, and he left. And although emotionally, she still is kind of shaken by it, they didn't get away with anything. But I raised that question because are dummy safes, is that something that we're doing in the retail?
So we have we have time delayed safes now that are like 5 minutes to sign stuff, but I have heard of people just putting desiccants in a bottle. Just so the fear, what she just said, is they'll come back because they didn't get anything.
Yep. And violence based off of that, because they didn't get anything.
So I'll learn more about this offline. I'll apologize. So they're tracker models. Okay, yeah. Very interesting. The positive thing is, I think we all agree, just give them what they want. It's interesting because they're still doing this pro meth with codeine thing, and so people who know about PERG, I feel like we need a CE on like street drugs. And someone asked me the other day, what is Molly? And as a pharmacist, I was embarrassed that I can't remember what Molly is. I think I should know what that is. My point is, this was a good conversation, good information to know, and I guess we'll continue to work towards safer environments. All right? All done? All right, so with that being said, the next item on our agenda is the fun part. Now is where we'll entertain comments from...
Excuse me. Oops. You have one other...
Oh, I'm so sorry. I saw that, and then I went past it. So the next item is 07. This is a request that the board has received for approval of continuing education programs around LGBTQ cultural competency. And so this is item 007. So before you have, board members, you've had an opportunity to review some of this information. And so we need to, take a vote in terms of whether or not we approve these or not. I will say this, if it's okay, to start the conversation. At least the first one that I looked at, I think we need to kind of remind ourselves of what the goal is with this LGBTQ cultural competency continuing education for healthcare professionals. So you have some sessions, and they specifically talk about some of the unique things that that the nuances around, you know, caring for the LGBTQ community in terms of certain definitions and certain health barriers that are experienced and things of that nature. When I looked at this particular, the first one, the program, it talked about fairness and diversity in the workplace. And so I don't know, I think as you consider whether or not these programs are worthy of becoming approved for continuing education for our pharmacists, I just want you to kind of just try to think back in terms of what is the overall training goal that we're trying to accomplish with this. So with that being said, your thoughts?
I think that's a really good point. Is the goal just to increase awareness about diversity, or is it to take it a step further to talk about the importance of the link between diversity and providing health care? That was my thought about what the purpose was, but then specifically in terms of the board's approval, and I'm sorry I didn't get it because I didn't have the agenda and see that in advance, but if I remember correctly, the law is very specific about what the training needs to include. And I think there were like 5 or 6 points. And so I think as a first order of business, typically at the front of every presentation is these are the objectives. The objectives should clearly parallel what the law says needs to be included in the training, and then I do think it's good for the board to actually go through the training and make sure and confirm that the content itself does support the objectives. But I think you raise a good point about
let's make sure that there's a tie-in with providing care to this particular population, if that is in fact, and we all agree that that's the intent for putting this together to begin with from the perspective of the council. I don't know if that is or not.
Yeah, and thank you for that reminder. Do we have those, do we have the regs that outline the specific things that are to be included in the training in here? Maybe I overlooked it. I could have used it. If we don't have it, if we can kind of get that, that would be awesome, because quite frankly, that should be our guide.
Yes.
You know, that will tell us what it is.
Exactly.
Any other thoughts around the...
Takes some of the subjectivity out of the approval.
Absolutely.
Do we know, is there any movement afoot at NABP to identify a number indicator in the ACPE number so that going forward we won't have to make this distinction?
I can tell, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. And I actually talked to Sean about that a couple months ago. She was at an NABP conference when we were texting about it. And she said that they don't yet have that on their agenda, and that it, they have to build out X number of months to include that. However, if there were approved programs through APCE, if we gave her the UAN numbers, she would pass that along to NABP, and that they would take that into consideration as part of the approval process to make it easier for the board. So whether it's official, probably not, that they'd be working on it, but if we give those numbers to Shauna, they would be sort of acceptable and help NABP in getting this process moving forward.
I think it's an excellent question, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't it be ACPE that has to come up with that UAN identifier for this particular... So, yeah, I mean, we can certainly, or we have colleagues who could certainly reach out and are more familiar with ACPE and the continuing education standards and what's on their radar.
But it's a process.
It would really be super helpful.
It's a formal process you have to go through, apparently.
The other observation I would have is, given the changes in our licensing approach, and given the fact that for many pharmacists it's all news that they have this requirement, we may need to have more flexibility in this first go-round than in future go-rounds when additional programming is available in the marketplace that specifically meets the requirements that might be set forth in the law, because we could have a situation in which 50% of people submitting their CE have done something that looks feels like cultural competence, and yet we deem not having met the sort of spirit of the law. So I think we ought to be careful about how we wade into this, so we don't create an issue for all of us. I mean, any diversity training, thoughtful training around LGBTQ issues is a help, even if it only meets 80% of the letter of what we stated, or 60% or something, at least for this first go-round, at least that's numbers.
So I think the other thing, that's a great point, and I think the other thing to remember too is that, Carla, correct me if I'm wrong, but the requirement is for all healthcare professions, right? It's not just for pharmacy.
Right.
So
right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be tied to pharmaceuticals, but healthcare in general. To your point, I agree there may be some room for flexibility, but I think there's a difference between taking a program where the content, you know, there's some flexible in the content versus not taking the CE at all when the requirement is that you have to take the CE, right? Yeah.
I just wanted to point out the second, for those of you who did get an opportunity to review these, although the first program was concerning, the second program looks outstanding. It does look like it fits the category, and I do just want to note one point. What the requirement says is, in terms of the education, at a minimum, it should provide information and skills to enable health professionals to care effectively and respectfully for patients who identify as LGBTQ. So back to the point of, if you have a program that's talking about, it's important to include this unique community in your workforce. That's a lot different than the intent behind the CE. But yeah, so again, I know you're probably just seeing the programs, but and maybe we might have to table approval of them.
But do you have the objectives in front of you or no?
For the law, second program?
For the law.
No, not for the law.
So here's my question also. If, help me understand, why is the ask for the board to approve these if they're ACPE approved programs? Why does the board have to approve? Or is this under that provision that it's not ACPE,
right,
but there are other programs that
right,
are looking for the board to
there
approve?
There you go.
Okay.
This is one of those other programs. Because
okay,
even now, you know, pharmacists can submit CEs from programs that are not ACPE accredited.
Right.
They have to have our approval.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay. So the only thing I would say is in terms of delaying approval of these, if, you know, time is not on everybody's side and we don't have another public session until April, so what's the guidance around, you know, not having approved it and then people are using it? Is that where our flexibility that Mr. Appleby's talking about is going to come into play, or what's the recommendation?
Yes, I think that is. If we don't, I don't recommend that we kind of rush through to do this, but we can look at it on a case-by-case basis if the person gets audited.
Okay. So, any other thoughts around this?
The two programs shown here, it certainly looks like the second one was designed specifically with the D.C. law in mind.
Yeah.
They set about coming up with a product that would meet a stated regulatory need. And the first one was developed by the Executive Office of the Mayor.
The first one was?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was about inclusion in the workforce.
But is it for health professionals or is it for
It's just very general.
It's in the workplace.
Yeah.
And health professionals are in workplaces.
We as D.C. government employees have to do a lot of this kind of training. So this could be one of the guys for us.
Okay. I actually just looking at this, the overall general law says 2 credits of instruction on cultural competency or specialized clinical training focusing on patients who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, gender nonconforming, queer, or questioning their sexual orientation or gender identity and expression, LGBTQ. Technically, the first one does meet the requirement. That's why I don't really want us to rush because it is on cultural competency.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I'm going to propose is we do kind of table approval of these right now, largely because we don't have the regs right in front of us, even though the second, I'm almost certain it does meet it, unless, you know, there's different thoughts around the table, but although I am compelled to offer support for the second one, it might be a good idea to just have the regs in front and then take a slightly more detailed look at both of them at the time. I am concerned about the timing and the requirement being a couple of weeks away, but to the points that have been made so far, there are two things. One, there are other programs that are out there, just like this second one, which is $55. Those that are out there are not free. At least, again, I haven't found one that's free. So there are things that are still out there. And then number two, it just might make a lot more sense to kind of have it in front of us, the rates in front.
So I like the idea. If we're going to be approving programs, to be fair and to be consistent, the regs provide the baseline, if in fact in the regs or the law, it gives us the training objectives. And then secondly, just keep in mind, I don't know if they're there or not, Carla?
I see at the, whichever one this is, B, on page 59 of our materials, they put the law on the flyer. So it says that it has to include 2 credits of instructional cultural competency or specialized clinical training, focusing on patients who identify as LGBTQ. The instructional part shall at minimum provide information and skills to enable a health professional to care effectively and respectfully for patients who identify as LGBTQ. So I think based on your discussion, it sounds like the second one is designed for health professionals. The first one is very employer workplace related. I'm not sure without having read any of it
how much it touches on a health professional dealing with a patient. So with that language in front of you, you may be able to at least approve B, even if you still want to reserve judgment on A.
I pulled up the regs, and this is what it says. The instruction required shall at a minimum provide information and skills to enable a health professional to care effectively and respectfully for patients who identify as LGBTQ, which may include, okay, which may include, and then it goes on to say, one, specialized clinical training relevant to patients who identified as LGBTQ, including training on how to use cultural information and terminology to establish clinical relationships. Two, training that improves understanding and application in a clinical setting with relevant data about health disparities and risk factors. Three, training that outlines legal obligations associated with treating patients. Four, best practices for collecting, storing, using, and keeping confidential information around sexual orientation and gender identity. Five, best practices for training support staff regarding treatment of patients who identify. Six, training that improves understanding interactions between systems of oppression and discrimination and improves recognition of these individuals. And next, training that addresses underlying cultural biases aimed at improving provisions of non-discriminatory care for patients who identify. Mm-hmm. So very specific, but again, the word is may as opposed to require. And then the other thing I was going to say was, so we talk about there's not a lot of free programs out there, and that's true perhaps in general for pharmacists, but keep in mind organizations or pharmacy companies, even independent pharmacies or pharmacy chains, may be putting together own training programs that they've applied to ACPE for credit and are offering their own staff. So that certainly can be in the works as well.
Yeah.
As long as they, you know, have the training requirements that they
have. Last, Madam Chair, it says on the agenda, request for approval of these things. Who is requesting the approval?
The two entities that submitted the courses.
And so I understand the entity that submitted the second course. What is the entity that submitted the first course?
I'm assuming it was the mayor's
office. May I?
Yes.
Okay, so we got two inquiries from one of our pharmacists, and they wanted to use that towards their pharmacist renewal. And so they were requesting to see if this will be approved for continuing education.
So it was the individual requesting.
Exactly.
On the corporation. Okay.
Gotcha.
And am I correct that the second one is a home study program that people study and then take the exam, and the first one is a live sort of in-service webinar based upon the 30 slides that are presented?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, all right. It seems to me that the marketplace is going to be looking for some clarity around what will pass muster and what won't. Is there... this is a direct inquiry from a pharmacist as to whether or not one or other of these meet the need.
Correct.
So, did we give them a response?
Not yet. I was informed we can bring it before the board.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Don't we have an obligation to give a response to an inquiry that came in? And if that's the case, I would move approval of the second course. Because it's clear that it's a self-contained home study program with questions, et cetera, et cetera.
That looks like it might already be approved by the Board of Medicine, by the way. So we need to check that.
Right. So if I understand now, it's not the program provider asking for us to approve it. It's an individual who wants to take the course.
Correct.
Correct.
I see. Okay. Then I think an answer should be provided.
I'm prepared to note to the board members that number two looks like in its current form it may satisfy the requirements.
I believe that number one satisfied the requirements as well.
Provided the person attended the live training program, right? It's not just you can look at the 30 slides. It's not a home study course, right? There's a slide that support a live training program.
Or some sort of...
Well, see, and this kind of goes into the whole thing about what's CE certified, you know? So it's not, whether it's ACPE certified, it doesn't have, you know, then it requires a test and what have you. But if they, and let me just pull up the law, I'm actually looking at this right now. but we want to keep on reminding us about all of the other ways that people can get continuing education credits, and that includes a lecture given by a government unit, a governmental unit. So it doesn't need a test or any of that, many of those other things. So it just depends whether or not, you know, typically this is looked over when everybody's doing their individual audit. You know, in terms of the response, I mean, they brought it towards for the whole board for pre-approval. That's totally different. So.
Put a motion on the floor to approve the second course, to respond to the pharmacist who's inquired, that to indicate that the second course would meet the continuing education requirement for cultural competence.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
All right, discussion? Is there general consensus?
I think there was some discussion.
Yeah, so I just have a question about that course. So is this a course that one... Is it a webinar? Is it a home study? Is there a competency afterwards?
How does there is a competency at the end of it, yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, is it a recorded thing, or you just read the slides?
Just read it.
Read it and then take the test after?
It's for CME credit.
And then, oh, CME, so you have to submit your answers to some body?
Yeah, it's through the faculty are from College of Medicine,
okay.
And it's really, you know, it's medical providers would also be taking that course as well.
Okay. And I'm assuming this course, the CE, is good for, well, it's got to be fairly new, so it's good for 2 years or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, okay. Thank you.
This is interesting, too, because it's from the District of Columbia Medical Licensure Program.
So I was aware... Because, you know, in our, when we're talking about birth control prescribing work group, one of the physicians had shared that there are a couple of programs that the physicians, and they have it on their website, and that it does have the medical CE associated, but there's a registration process to go through, and the question was, you know, whether we could get through the registration process or not. They were showing me how to do it, but I like the idea that you could just, I'm just assuming one could take this and then apply for the credit and not have to be approved for that registration process. That was a different thing.
Yeah, it says right here that there's a website you go to and you get a certificate.
Okay.
And your answers.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Any more discussion? So is there general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yeah.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? That motion carries. So... we will communicate to the pharmacist that the second program has received approval.
Okay. So then I have a question about the first program.
Mm-hmm.
And let me, if I could, just for language, Madam Chair,
yes.
I think it's important to say that it's not received approval, but that we deem it would meet the requirements of.
I'll make that clear.
Because we're not really approving that, right?
I understand. I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Satisfied
with
requirements.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So then with respect to the first program, when we talk about satisfying the requirement, I've never seen a CE before where somebody can just read slides and then just say, I've taken it. Like there's no formal CE given or taken or... If you go to association meetings, you don't necessarily have to take assessments after the fact. You have to evaluate the program. You don't always have to take a test. So that's not a requirement, even though ACP likes it, but it's not a requirement. But with this, I'm just not sure that taking it satisfies the need of CE.
I'm skimming this, but it really seems to be one of the courses designed for us as employees. If you look at pages 27 and 28 regarding why are we here and kind of the purposes for it. The course is a crucial component in reinforcing the district's policies and overall commitment to diversity and inclusion, emphasizing the importance of diversity and equal treatment for all employees and constituents. You'll
Thank
receive
you.
The insight and information needed to affect the interactive LGBT community on
whether they're your coworkers or members of the public. 28. And after completing this course, the participants should have a basic working knowledge of the community and be able to express understanding of the LGBTQ people, an increased knowledge and understanding of cultural competency terms, definitions relating to it, express increased knowledge of the challenges faced by that community, and the ability to address co-workers and constituents in a respectful and culturally competent manner as part of our daily interactions. That's probably why it doesn't have any type of test after it, because we as employees are just required to do it, and then we do it through a portal, and it tracks that we did it.
Yeah, I'm looking at one of the slides, so it talks about consequences when respect is absent. Diminished credibility in your agency, your coworkers lose respect for your agency, may get sued, you may be fired and sued.
Exactly. I think this is designed for us as employees for the most part. I don't know if it meets, it would satisfy the department. But
well, to Dr. McCann's earlier point, though, if a pharmacist that worked for D.C., for example, can prove that he or she went to this course, and it was 2 hours in duration, and they submitted it as their mechanism for meeting the requirement under the law, I think it's pretty likely they'd probably get approval for that.
If I was reviewing it, I would have.
But that's an after-the-fact thing. I don't think we can pre-approve it because we don't know how long it lasts.
We
don't know if it's live, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's one of those items that we would consider after the fact and not in advance.
But remember, the law says that the training is supposed to provide the information and skills for the health professional to care for these patients. So can you glean some of that probably, but is it targeted and intended for that? Not really.
It's a moot point, though. This won't happen until after the fact. No one's put a motion forward to approve to tell the pharmacist this would meet the needs. I'm just saying, if after the fact someone used it, we would have to decide as a group.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's a good discussion. So, anything else or?
My suggestion is to be kind of lenient, especially with it being the first time this is happening, and we have a clear,
speak up a little bit.
My suggestion is that we are a little clear, that we are very lenient with this, especially because it's the first time there isn't necessarily a clear CE that is out there. So, it's a little, as far as like answering questions from pharmacists, as far as approval of different CEs, if there isn't anything in place at this time, it's like an official CE for us to do.
So I thank you for that. I think the take-home message is we will, as a board, we will gladly review and be a bit flexible during the audit of our pharmacists. Colleagues as they submit their documentation, because we already know there's going to be a group that will have to definitely submit documentation of doing this CE requirement, and in those audits we need to exercise some leniency, frankly. Okay. Anything else? All right. So now we will entertain comments.
I did have one other item.
Okay. Yeah, no, you go.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Positive.
I was trying to pick up on council's earlier comment regarding our official policy statement having to do with CPR being live.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got the sense that we may need a motion of the board to say, yes, please develop such policy. So if that's the case, I'll move that the board request council to prepare a policy statement regarding the fact that CPR training for organization requirements should be must be live.
A second.
Okay, so we have a motion that's been made and seconded. Any discussion? I have a question. So currently in the reg for those pharmacists who wish to have vaccination authority, what does it say about CPR? Because is it a matter of just clarifying that, or it has
the policy statement is to clarify that. So it says you have to have CPR
your current CPR health professionals, I believe.
Okay.
But it didn't specify lives, so you had an inquiry for someone who they did it all on the internet.
Okay.
And so the board did not accept that, and you took the official position that that would not be accepted. But the policy statement will go on the website
to clarify that
and make sure everyone knows up front.
Gotcha. Okay.
The board's position.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, so there's a motion that's been made and seconded. Ready for the vote? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? That motion carries. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yeah. So NABP is coming up?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's in Minnesota, right? Minneapolis, right?
And
I just wanted to, so I saw, I think, an email from you.
Yes.
And I think Ms. Sanders expressed some interest. I wasn't sure. I just want to make sure. I don't know. I just want to make sure the board is going to have representation there.
So, absolutely. So, thank you for that. I have requested to attend, especially as the District 2 chair. District 2 chair. So, I'll be attending, and we actually have an opportunity for an additional board member to attend.
There's a grant.
Yes.
You can use grant money
yes.
for that. Right?
And so, I am eager to hear which of my board colleagues would also like to attend this outstanding meeting in May. In Minnesota. So,
you're referencing it is May, so it's safe to go to Minnesota. It's warm enough.
So I don't know, are any of you interested in going? I would hate to be the only one, but D.C. will absolutely continue to represent.
It was funny at the at the regional meeting that we had here,
yeah.
So you know when they made their pitch.
Yeah.
Oh no.
You're
sorry, that wasn't. I was talking about the
Vermont.
Next regional Vermont because
yeah.
I remember a lot of talk about beer.
Yeah.
Breweries.
When we go to Vermont in September, you know, there's going to be a golf outing,
right?
Thing to Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
so
yeah.
This is Mall of America.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it doesn't sound like right now anyone has had an opportunity to kind of check your calendars or anything, but when you do get a chance, again, there's an opportunity for another board member to go. Otherwise, I'll just be out there having all the fun, going to all the meetings, all of them.
Shauna
will be there. I think she has another conflict towards the end of the meeting, but she will be there at least for a portion. Okay. But thank you for bringing that up because I told her I would bring it up. Anything else? We had a long open session today. You guys still with us? Okay. Yes, comments from the public. That's what it's time for.
Just so I understand, the formal disposition of letter A for 0207, letter B was passed unanimously, right?
Yes.
What's the disposition on letter A?
I think it will require further review, but in terms of approving a program, that's not something that we're doing right now. But in terms of what will we accept as proper evidence for satisfying the requirement, we're willing to, at this time, not accept A, but B, yes.
So it's not
I wouldn't say neither of them are approved, but program B will meet the requirement. It will satisfy the requirement.
Well, all right. I wrote down after you had a vote and was approved unanimously.
B.
Letter B.
Mm-hmm.
So letter A was not approved.
Mm-hmm. Right. You can use approve, but I just want to, you know, make it clear that we are not necessarily approving the program in its entirety as being a program that meets the requirement. But right now we are saying this pharmacist can use program B to satisfy that requirement.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Okay.
I sound like I'm talking in circles.
Yeah.
No, then you make
I don't know if it helps, but a specific pharmacist is asking the board, will this satisfy the requirement? The board is comfortable and has voted B will satisfy.
Right.
The board cannot today say that A will satisfy.
Fine.
Okay.
To that end, and thank you for raising that, Don. Do we need to actually pass a motion indicating that the board considered the other item and we have decided to indicate that we cannot determine if it would meet the requirements? I mean,
or say A is...
Do we need an answer on record?
Based on the information presented today, and I know there was questions about
you know, there's more information that could maybe change your mind. Based on what was presented today, the board cannot say this would satisfy the requirement, would be the official position.
And does that need to be included in the communication that goes to the pharmacist?
And that could be, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And do you want a formal motion on that?
It's relevant to this discussion. So the law indicates that under paragraph A, right, it's either the instruction has to have cultural competency or specialized clinical training focused on these patients. And then the instruction, at a minimum, needs to provide information and skills to enable a healthcare professional to care effectively and respectfully for patients who identify as LGBTQ. So I think the question you have to ask is, does the CE that's provided in letter A, does it meet that minimum threshold? The minimum that is providing information and skills to enable that healthcare professional to care effectively and respectfully for these patients. So you may want to consider as a board, maybe considering a policy of some kind to identify what are those minimum things that you might be looking for in a program to identify what those things are. So for example, one of the things I noticed in there was nothing about confidentiality information. So maybe something around that, maybe something that you may want to consider as one of the minimum items. Or there might be other things that you might want to consider that are already outlined under subsection B. There's seven things that the law has. Mm-hmm. You may want to consider, hey, this one thing has to be in the program that we're looking for. But there might be other things. But just something to consider before you vote.
Yeah.
We were responding to a particular person, but if you want to formalize it, that's fine. That's based on what you have right now. You cannot say that A satisfies it. It doesn't mean that more information may not change your mind.
So, colleagues, we can take a vote on the matter of A just to make the response to the promises a bit more official.
So I'll make a motion in response to 020707A at this time. The board feels that the program does not meet the requirement.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Discussion?
Okay.
So does that then lock us in if after the fact someone can prove that it was a 2-hour course, this, that, and everything? Or we're not able to make a determination because we actually don't have all the facts, right?
So maybe the wording can be that based upon the information presented today, the board does not find sufficient information to determine that it would satisfy the bargaining process. And that leaves it open that certainly more information could be provided later, or someone could take the course.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that wording. And I think that, you make some great points. And we're perhaps, teasing out certain things. I just want to make sure that, we're trying to be as fair and equitable as possible, as flexible as possible, meet the intent, and keep in mind the one thing that is clear here is it says must include 2 hours of instruction. So if you think about other CEs that we have in place, there's nothing out there that, I don't think we've ever accepted anything, nor would ACPE, that says you can just read 20 slides and then tell the board, I've done my CE, because, gosh, just imagine what would do the CE world, right, if it were that easy. So I think that's the thing, and I think Carla's wording is really good because it provides the structure that we need right now until we perhaps got more information about how it's delivered, that sort of thing, to meet the 2 CE requirement. The content, that's, I think, maybe debatable.
I want to be clear that I'm going to be voting in opposition to this motion because I do believe that there is content in there that will be beneficial to healthcare professionals to increase their competency for the LGBTQ community.
Okay. All right. So any more discussion? So is there general consensus in favor? So we need to do a roll call vote. All right. So we'll do a roll call vote, and we'll start with... We'll start with Ben.
Benjamin Miles, I am also not in favor of the motion.
Okay. Alan?
In favor of the motion.
Not in favor of the motion.
James Appleby, I'm in favor of the motion.
Daphne Bernard, I'm in favor of the motion. So the motion carries. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Thank you for that. All right, any other comments from the public? Yes.
Do you guys have any information on USP 800 enforcement? I've been getting a lot of questions around PPE and what happens to this drug. Is there any one heard or any information on enforcement of USP 800?
So I think that's probably something that pharmaceutical control would probably be on. Yeah. So I don't know if Chief has anything to share.
I'm going to have to get that to Sean, we can get back to you if you contact information.
Actually, better yet, if you don't mind, could you send an email to Shauna so that specific, you know, she may be able to respond better to that?
Sure. So can I just, great question. And just one point for consideration about USP 800. You know, our structure is unique in D.C. because of Board of Pharmacy and Pharmacy Control Division. I will just say for the record that there are other boards of pharmacy because it is within their purview to address that question. And I do think it should be addressed because there does need to be guidance at the local jurisdiction level in terms of expectations to be in compliance with the federal requirement. And there are, even our neighboring jurisdictions are putting together guidance to be clear about what that agency's expectation is, whether it's sooner, later, how it's going to affect inspections. And in the case of Virginia, they put guidance together, and then they actually were challenged and changed their guidance to be in line with the federal requirement. And as you know, the federal requirement has moved as well. Their implementation date was later because there was a lot of pushback. Hospitals in particular just couldn't meet the demand quite quickly enough. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely think that just as a healthcare professional, we need to get some guidance out there because, yeah.
Definitely.
Thank you.
And so just thank you for that, Ellen. And just to, again, be clear, where our structure in D.C., those kind of questions and oversight of what happens in the pharmacy, that actually falls under pharmaceutical control. So I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying that's not within our wheelhouse at the Board of Pharmacy. But luckily, the person who oversees that other area is at the table and can convey that to Shauna. And then if you could kind of send a communication, if you think it would be helpful, that would be good, too.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from you lovely community members? Yes.
So, hi, Jennifer Thomas with Clarence, and we are offering a education piece, not a CE, but on immunization next week, the 13th. It will be at noon. It's a WebEx, and it will include the herpes zoster, the newest vaccine, Shingrix, and what's new and happening with that, including questions about supplies. I encourage you to attend and ask. Speaker, and also influenza will be the second half of the program. So, what's happening with the influenza activity this year, vaccine effectiveness? There's new guidelines by IDSA, clinical guidelines for prophylaxis and influenza treatment. There's also a new drug. So, just for all of you, and that message has gone out. So, I hope we'll have some additional attendance.
Question, Jennifer. That drug, I know last year it had been on back order for a long time, and so there was some concern from the part of healthcare professionals, even patients, of getting it because it requires the second dose like 6 months later or something. Do you know, is back order still a problem? Or?
So you're talking about the Shingrix vaccine?
I am, yeah.
Yes, my understanding is supply is out versus demand, so much more demand than the supply is available.
So, okay.
You know, when you're going to the pharmacy and the folks that are working in the pharmacies, you put them in a line, I think.
Our distribution center started getting them back in about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, good.
But our stores were able to get them. We just have really long lists of people that were waiting, so the people that had the first dose, you know.
Yeah, take priority because, yeah.
It's there, it's there.
Yeah.
So our stores aren't getting them.
Good, thanks.
And then there'll be some response also to, well, what if you don't get it within a 6 month time period?
Right.
So I encourage you all to, if you're interested, to tune in and ask the question. It is being presented by a GSK medical scientific liaison, but she'll be very non-biased. She's very good at presenting the evidence data.
When is that again? Sorry?
It's the 13th. And that message, I know it's gone out to Shauna. She's on our distribution list. I don't know if I have all of you on it, but I can certainly add that and send it out again.
Did I see another hand? You're probably stretching. Keep from dozing off.
Is that Ms. Portia? Okay. So I just want, as everyone is scrambling for their CEs, to announce two dates for a continuing education program. So on Saturday, February 23rd, Howard University College of Pharmacy is hosting the regional SNAPA conference, the Student National Pharmaceutical Association. And they are offering 4 hours of continuing education. So we have put together a discounted price for pharmacists just to attend the CEs and to have lunch on their own. So the topics that will be presented will include an immunization update, pharmacist's role in addressing substance abuse, the U.S. shift from volume to value, and clinical considerations for medicinal cannabis for a total of 4 live continuing education hours. That's going to be on Saturday, February 23rd. And the next is to please save the date for Sunday, February 24th. The Howard University Office of Continuing Pharmacy Education will be hosting a joint CE program with pharmacists and nurse practitioners, including topics, immunization update as well, LGBTQ, and a law update. So just save the date.
And also, additional CE for anybody that also may be licensed in Maryland, the Maryland Pharmacists Association is having their annual meeting this Sunday. It's, I think, University of Maryland. There's a Marriott in Hyattsville. And there are 7 hours of CE. It's from like 7:30 to 5:30. And I know that they're offering an hour of LGBTQ cultural competency, and I believe HIV as well.
One hour each.
Yeah. And so you can go to the MPHA website if you want to get more information.
Now, remember, for us, you got to have 2 hours.
Right.
In case you're missing an hour, that might be great. But thank you for that information. How much is it to attend the meeting?
Depends if you're a member or not. But all that's on the MPHA website.
Any other comments? All right. So if there's no other business for the opening session, we will now entertain a motion from one of our board members to adjourn.
You drew the short straw.
Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to 2-575B9, to seek advice of the counsel to the board, to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 2-575B4, and to plan, discuss, or hear reports concerning ongoing or planned investigations pursuant to 2-575B14.
Thank you for that. Well done. So we have a motion that's in place. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, we'll take a roll call vote, starting with
Benjamin Miles in favor of the motion.
Alan Friedman in favor.
Tamara McCants in favor.
James Appleby.
Daphne Bernard in favor of the motion. And this concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the reasons set forth in the motion. So I want to thank you all for your patience. Thank you for attending and giving your great input, and we look forward to seeing you in April, right? At our next full board meeting where we will conduct the business of the board. So thank you again. We'll now segue into executive session, and so again, we look forward to seeing you. Thank you for coming. If you did not sign the attendance roster, please do so. That's good. That's good.